Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to You and Me at 30. I am your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. You and Me at 30 is a new talk show bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussions on a variety of topics. While many of our guests will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and the local community, I will also feature individuals from around the country. Please note that the views and opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. There are more than 20 million veterans in the United States. They are the men and women who have served on active duty in any branch of the armed forces, in peacetime or war. Veterans make up 6.5% of the total population. 26 of our 45 presidents have been veterans. Veterans Day originated as Armistice Day on November 11, 1911, the first anniversary of the end of World War I. Congress passed a resolution in 1926 for an annual observance, and November 11th became a national holiday beginning in 1938. Unlike Memorial Day, Veterans Day pays tribute to all American veterans, living or dead. Today's guest is Mr. Rick Whitehurst. Rick is the son of a World War II veteran. Rick served in the U.S. Army for 3 years. He spent 13 months in the Vietnam War and was involved in the infamous Tet Offensive. Rick is a native of Virginia, and he currently resides in Maryland. Rick, thank you so much for joining me today.
Dr. Wright, thank you for having me.
So, Rick, let's get started. You completed 2 years of college at Norfolk State University in Virginia. Then you got drafted to serve in the Army. You completed boot camps in North Carolina and Arizona, and then you went to Vietnam during the war. What do you remember about those first few weeks in Vietnam?
My introduction to Vietnam goes like this. When I landed in Vietnam on a C-130, that aircraft with the large door in the rear where you enter and exit, when that door came open and the heat from that country literally grabbed me around the neck, it was one of the hottest experiences that I have had landing in another country. A country boy, I'm Virginia Beach native. I really had not did any traveling, but when the military was my first real experience. So when I landed in Vietnam, it was the base camp of the 1st Cav. That was my combat unit, the 1st Air Cavalry.
Your father was a World War II veteran. Growing up, were you heavily influenced by the military? Did you see yourself having a career in the military or serving in the war at some point in life?
I was very aware of my father's service time. His pictures and his duty stations and where he was doing World War II was very evident around my home. It was something that I grew up knowing he was a part of, and I always respected the men in uniform, men and women that was in uniform. And being from Virginia Beach, it's a very heavily military area, so I was used to seeing all branches of military life.
Let me ask you this. When I was a kid coming up, you know, I watched a lot of movies, and one of the movies I remember watching was Full Metal Jacket. And that movie, which is about the Vietnam War, they spend probably the first 45 minutes just focusing on the soldiers' experience in boot camp as they're getting ready before they even go out to the battlefields in Vietnam. How would you say your boot camp experience prepared you, or could it prepare you at all for what you really experienced once you got out there in Vietnam?
When I was in boot camp, it was Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and it is a well-organized and a historic military installation. As a matter of fact, the 82nd Airborne comes out of Fort Bragg. I did boot camp there at Fort Bragg, and that preparation really got me in the mindset of just what I might be coming in contact with during my stay in the military. From Fort Bragg, I went to Fort Ochoa, and that's where I did my advanced infantry training at Fort Huachuca. And from Fort Huachuca, I came down on orders to go to the Republic of Vietnam.
And in terms of the fighting, talk about that, being in those jungles and the Agent Orange and everything. Tell me something about that.
Up north Vietnam is where I concentrated. The Highland Territories on one of the Vietnamese maps is very strongly outlined. North Vietnam is very close to the DMZ. And we, the soldiers in my outfit, concentrated down on what we refer to as the Ho Chi Minh Trail. When I was preparing myself for Vietnam, I took it very seriously. And eventually, out of Arizona, which is a hot part of the country, they had a reconstructed area that they tried to make look like the jungles of Vietnam to get us somewhat familiar with and accustomed to what the heat was already there. And so by the time we hit some of the mountains of Arizona, it got real in the sense of the heat and the fatigue that one would go through getting introduced to Vietnam. With that training we had, I only could picture what was coming because of the preparation that they was introducing us to. So I knew it was going to be tough. I knew that.
And just for the audience, so Rick spoke in one of my classes not too long ago, and he was telling the students about his experiences. And Rick, I remember one of the things you brought up in that discussion was the difficulty in trying to determine who was who, meaning like civilian versus the enemy. Can you talk about that?
That is a very, very good and sensitive question. The first Vietnamese people that I came in contact is what we describe as black pajama Vietnamese. Okay. Now, black pajama Vietnamese, they wore just that, the black silk-like material, and it was top and bottom black with the very light flip-flop shoes. The only problem there is when you got in a village where I was, the enemy, the VC or the NVA, could infiltrate what we thought was regular civilian villages, and they played a double role. They could be the VC by night, and they could be Vietnamese regulars by day.
Hey, Rick. Rick, real fast, can you just tell the audience what you mean when you say VC?
The VC is the acronym for the Viet Cong. That Viet Cong is the guerrilla soldier in Vietnam that is a well-trained military person, can carry out all kinds of military assignments, and is very good at what they do. So the Viet Cong is that guerrilla type Vietnamese soldier. The NVA is the North Vietnamese Army, and that is a well-trained military unit that can compete with any military body that we come in contact with, regardless of
And who was Ho Chi Minh?
Ho Chi Minh was the leader of North Vietnam. He was the political power. What he says went. How he ran that North Vietnam was the communist part of the country. And so that was up north. South was more the democratic part in the United States. And the part that I participated in was trying to keep South Vietnam, which was that democratic process, from being totally dominated by North Vietnam, which was the communist side.
And right now I'm looking at a photo. This is a picture of yourself, and I believe you're standing on top of a tank holding a machine gun. Can you describe that photo to our listeners?
That tank is on the perimeter of LZ Geronimo, one of the landing zones that I fought from. And during the daytime, when that picture was taken, the tank unit, that squadron, the helmets is all over the tank. They left them right from their fighting stations. One of the helmets is hanging on the butt of a 60 caliber machine gun. One of my favorite weapons on there. And that is also mounted on the tank along with a 50 and then the big tube. So the tank itself will come on the perimeter just where I was, and during the most peaceful times at high noon when we was at our most relaxed eating and everybody was stationed no more than 15, 20 yards away from their fighting station. So the helmets on that you see on that tank, those guys are right on the ground and could get in position and do their combat assignments in less than 30 seconds.
And you told my students when you were talking to them about your gun and how basically, you know, you slept with this gun. You said you treated it sometimes better than you treated yourself during those 13 months?
Yes, that was my M16. That was the most popular weapon during my time in Vietnam, which was 67 and 68. The M16 weapon is the one that is the model automatic weapon. It can be switched to semi-automatic and then fully automatic. It is the same weapon that just a lot of copycat weapons assembled after or trying to resemble and does the same thing. The only thing with the M16 in Vietnam, the automatic switch that you can flip from fully automatic to semi-automatic is these weapons stateside that is being used for all of the wrong reasons is what makes it an assault weapon and designed only for killing. You can't do anything with an M16 or the similar weapons in the States, the 15s, the assault weapons that's being used by the kids doing all kinds of crazy things. That is an assault weapon, and it's designed to kill people. I carried it every day. I cleaned it, kept it in top working condition, and that was my pass, my green light, to be able to function every day while I was in Vietnam. And it was the most important part of my equipment.
Rick, tell us about Agent Orange, like what it was used for and how it affected not just the VC, but also the U.S. soldiers.
We were in, when we were in the bush, right outside of some of the landing zones, when we had to travel to the jungles, and we had all kinds of complications because the terrain was so dense. The officials that ran this war came up with a vegetation killer, and it was Agent Orange. The thing that the soldiers in my position was not aware of, we didn't know when and where it was going to be sprayed or deposited on the foliage or the jungle area. So oftentimes we were moving on the ground, and the planes that distributed this pesticide was putting it right in the areas that we were operating in. We ended up walking into terrain that was wet with it. We ended up, in some cases, some of the GIs when we came back on stand down, that was a area in the rear when we needed to get refreshed, new clothing, new boots, and get a chance to just take care of your hygiene. And that's when we found out this vegetation killer was being dumped right in the area and on some of the soldiers. Now, as time went on, unbeknown to any of us, that this thing ended up being a deadly insecticide that penetrated the skin and attacked the human beings in the chest area, mostly dealing with the lungs and your passageways for breathing. I attended three funerals with the guys that I served with that came down with Agent Orange. Now, I knew that they was dumping this stuff and spraying it, but fortunately for me, I was so sensitive to being wet with this stuff. I had a light odor, and it made me sick. I got nauseated from it. And I think that was a plus for me. But when I was nauseated, and the first thing I did was got out of all of my clothes because I couldn't stand the smell of it, and requested and did what I had to do to get me some new fatigues. And a lot of guys had that problem with that insecticide. Later on, it ended up doing what it's doing now. It ended up killing people.
And Rick, you also were a part of the Tet Offensive. And in about 30 seconds, can you just say what that was for the audience?
The Tet Offensive is the Vietnamese New Year's holiday. And for some reason, the United States honored that New Year's holiday for the Vietnamese and the Viet Cong and the NVA. We did not know that our leaders was going to have a ceasefire during their holiday. And what happened was they did everything they needed to do to reinforce their position, to stock their firepower, to get themselves in position for when the holiday was over with and the fighting started. They had the upper hand. And that's exactly what happened.
And for those of you not familiar with the Tet Offensive, that was a major turning point in the war. And that's a point where many Americans who thought we were winning the war, you know, realized that we were losing the war. So very important moment in the war. Ladies and gentlemen, again, you're listening to UMES 30. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua Wright from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, where I teach history. My guest today is Vietnam veteran Rick Whitehurst. So Rick, we know that this war was happening during the midst of the civil rights movement back in the United States. And there was a story you shared with me about a fellow white soldier from Montana and how being in the war kind of changed his outlook on race relations. Can you say something about that very briefly?
Chris was raised to be a racist. He was a very prejudiced individual. People of color didn't give them any respect. Family had money, and the only thing he wanted to do was get this 2 years over with and get back to his home where he had all of the best things of life. Chris had a problem, like I said, with people of color, and him and I butted heads, and it wasn't very nice for the simple reason that I didn't have a safety zone. I went from zero to code red in a very short period of time. That was just my nature. And he touched on his attitude and his prejudice demeanor carried me from zero to code red, very short period of time, and I was ready to hurt him. And I realized that that was a fellow soldier, and I needed to check myself because, like I said, there's no gray area with me. It's one or the other. So he and I finally got to a point where we didn't communicate. He went his way and I went mine, and we both respected the fact that it was a very, very dangerous moment for the both of us. And he had all of the key buttons to push with a personality like mine, a country boy from Virginia Beach. I didn't have a lot of that racial experience at 19 years old. And my parents kind of guarded us from that. It was certainly in my area where I grew up. But we was kind of shielded from that, and I got to know it as I went on in life as an adult. And one of the big parts of it developed in the military. And a lot of people don't know that combat area, it's not all brotherly love, because some of the personalities come in there showing you the way they came up and what they believed in. And that's what happened to Chris and I.
So, Rick, after the war, you came back home, and eventually you worked as a police officer in Washington, D.C. for over 20 years. So this is the question. I'm going to ask if you could just respond in about 30 seconds to this question. So when, as a former police officer and also a Vietnam veteran, when you see the athletes, particularly the ones in the NFL, doing these anthem protests, and kneeling during the national anthem and, you know, the flag, how does that make you feel?
It's a very difficult subject for me, dealing with the people that I served with, police officers that was on both sides of that issue. The belief of some people being able to exercise whatever they believe in made it very difficult for me, being a vet. And it is very clear with me, and I make no hesitation, I think they're wrong, period. I think not showing the patriotism for the colors is wrong. I know a lot of people probably don't agree with me, but that's my position. I think the country deserves, the veterans deserve, the people around the globe in uniform for this country, they deserve to be recognized for what their patriotism and the level of it for this country.
My final question, are you suffering any physical ailments or any post-traumatic stress disorder from your time in the war?
On the post-traumatic stress disorder once returning from Vietnam and trying to resume a normal life, join the police department here in D.C. And what I found was happening to me was I could not sleep. And the reason I couldn't sleep was because I had thoughts of Vietnam, and I wasn't dreaming. In my case, I was wide awake. I just stayed awake the whole time. Oftentimes, I stayed awake all night. It was nothing but when I went through an episode like that for me to be awake 15, 20 hours. And that was an all-night shift for me. And it bothered me to the degree that I sought out and went to the Veterans Administration Medical Hospital in D.C. to find out from a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and my internal medicine personnel that I was suffering from PTSD.
And then also, in terms of your physical ailments, I know you had, a knee replacement?
I was hit with shrapnel, and it was not bad at the time, but it went in below my waist, hit my knees, and they couldn't get it out. One of the orthopedic surgeons said it would best be left in there because it wasn't doing anything. After about 15 years, it started to move. When they found out it was moving, it was doing a lot of damage. So they ended up going in a very sensitive or highly difficult area to remove this metal out of both knees. And in doing so, before they could get to it, the metal moved to what the ACL, the MCL, and they ended up replacing my knees because there was nothing in there to stabilize them. And the injuries to my knees came from an explosive that we call a mortar round and or grenade.
So, Rick, we are out of time. I know we could sit here and talk for hours about the subject. I just want to say thank you so much for your service to the military and also your service as a police officer. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Dr. Wright, totally appreciate the invite, and thank you for having me.
We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here's when I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general. This piqued my interest. For this week's Parting Shots, I want to focus on the story of Kathy Williams. Kathy was the first African-American woman to enlist and the only woman documented to serve in the United States Army posing as a man. Williams, a former slave from Missouri, enlisted under the pseudonym William Kathy. She served in the military from 1866 to 1868 and was assigned to the 38th Infantry Regiment. In 2018, the Private Kathy Williams Monument Bench was unveiled on the Walk of Honor at the National Infantry Museum in Columbus, Georgia. Wow, that's a really fascinating story. If I was a Hollywood producer, I would definitely think about turning that into a movie. Thanks again to our guest today, Mr. Rick Whitehurst. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and social media. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.